Today we discuss how the brain works. Humans have the most complex brain of any animal on Earth. Even when we sleep, the brain is still working. Joining us today to talk about the brain and how depression, anxiety, or disease impacts brain function is psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Good morning, Dr. Whaley.
Good morning, Minnie. Glad to be here.
So there's a lot of things going on inside our brains, sort of this like super highway of nerve cells that connect the brain to the rest of our body. In fact, I looked it up. An adult brain contains 100 billion nerve cells or neurons, which branches that connect out to the more than 100 trillion points. It's hard to imagine that.
Yeah, those numbers are incredible. And the brain processes information with these neurons through connections. And processes, one nerve cell will activate another electrically. That's how we do everything, through these connections. And just to bring home the, if you want to have another interesting piece about the numbers, if every person who has about three pounds of brain in their skull, if they were to distribute all their neurons to everybody on Earth, everybody would receive about 16 of their neurons. That just brings home the numbers that
amazing.
Are there.
All right, so since we're talking about the neurons, the neurons are the type of cell that's destroyed by Alzheimer's disease. So what's going on in the brain with Alzheimer's?
Well, Alzheimer's disease comes from the brain over the years produces substances that are like garbage and need to be removed. And sometimes the garbage is abnormal. And what happens with Alzheimer's disease is there's a buildup of garbage that are seen under the microscope as plaques and also what's called tangles. The two different proteins that build up in abnormal amounts. These abnormal proteins result in basically nerve cell death, a neuron dying. It starts with the synapse and then basically results in the destruction of the nerve cells. Mm-hmm. So basically, it's a enhanced or a rapid loss of nerve cells is what produces the symptoms of
Alzheimer's. So that's why we're seeing little, you lose these little connections, and then so you're losing a little bit of memory here, a little bit there, and then of course it eventually you lose body function, brain telling your body what to do to breathe and swallow and all of those things.
Well, that's the very end stage, but before you get there, you lose all sorts of mental processes that you need for general life, just figuring out what's in the environment, how to do things, eating, remembering how to chew, all sorts of basic neurological functions.
Yeah. We're talking about how the brain works this morning. Our toll-free number, if you have questions or comments for us, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. One thing that I've always thought sort of fascinating about the brain is that whole right brain, left brain thing. You know, the right brain controlling the left part of our body, left brain controlling the right side. So in the case of stroke victims, if you're having the problems with the left side of your body, having the issues, it means that the right side of your brain is where you've had the stroke.
That's correct. Yeah.
And that we have all these different areas that, I guess, control different jobs, let's say.
They're all doing different jobs, but they also can compensate for one another. There's a lot of integration, and for every function that we localize in a particular part of the brain, we also see it mirrored, or it can be compensated for by some other areas to some extent, not everything.
Yeah, that compensation is really fascinating because, I mean, I guess this is one of the areas that it just seemed kind of like a mystery to us is you have two people who could have the same injury, and that compensation could be different in both of them.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. The more we know about the brain, the more complex it is. It'd be nice to have this show 100 years from now and look back at what we're talking about now.
I know, because it seems the more you learn, the more questions you have.
Absolutely.
I wanted to talk about, since we mentioned Alzheimer's, the aging brain. And I know we've talked about this many times on this program, but it's a subject that still continues to interest a lot of us. There's a great article in the New York Times in January on how to train the aging brain. And it cites the work of Dr. Deborah Burke, who's done some research on TOTS, those tip of the tongue times when you know something, but you can't quite call it to mind. We've all had them. And it's so frustrating because you know it, and I have it happen to me sometimes where all of a sudden I can't spell a word that I know. And it drives me crazy.
Sure.
So her research shows that such incidents increase in part because neural connections can weaken with age or disuse. which is fascinating.
Yeah, use it or lose it.
Use it or lose it, right. And then, but she also finds that if you are primed with sounds that are close to those you're trying to remember, it'll suddenly pop into your head. And they give the example in this article of trying to remember Brad Pitt's name and somebody talking about cherries.
Correct.
And you get it. So there's some, that's sort of some good news, bad news in there.
Well, our brain, one of the major ways our brain does work is through association. That's so evident in everything we experience, how we associate, how we filter out what we experience. And it's associated with previous memories. Mm-hmm. And so that we re-experience our past in our present. And that's really the food for psychiatry, certainly, yeah. And food for psychotherapy.
Yeah. One of the things I'm thinking, too, is as you get a little bit older, we have a tendency to sort of get nostalgic and think back. And some of those memories from earlier in our lives seem to be clearer than some of the memories that are current.
That's right. Well, you've had more time to rehearse those memories, one reason. And that actually is what happens when you're asleep. Or when you're doing nothing, the brain is still very active. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, there's some recent research that shows that it's about 9 times more active in terms of how much energy is consumed when you're just kind of sitting and daydreaming than you are when you're like reading or engaged in some task.
You know, one of the things I always found interesting too is a lot of people will say, you know, they've got a problem, whatever that problem may be, and they're looking for an answer. And, you know, they always sleep on it. You know,
That's
they
right.
say, go to sleep on it. And you'll wake up. And first thing in the morning, all of a sudden, the answer is right there. And you think, why didn't I think of that before? Right. Maybe that has something to do with
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. You've processed it and it becomes clear. You then can see clearer as opposed to like a traffic jam with all the competing stimuli coming into one point and blocking one another.
Yeah. Let's talk about some diseases of the brain and what happens. I'm thinking a schizophrenia for one. That's a disease that's like, you know, progresses. But you can, as a young person, a lot of times you may not even have any symptoms yet, right?
Oh, that's right. The thought about schizophrenia is there are probable brain abnormalities that may be detected early in childhood, but that doesn't mean that those persons are going to become schizophrenic. Mm-hmm. It seems that the symptoms start most generally in adolescence or late adolescence, and that's when the brain is undergoing what's called pruning, cutting back of connections that aren't necessary. So that if there's some miswiring that has occurred based on genetics and what the child is born with, or maybe a viral infection in utero or shortly after birth, so that there's some miswiring, it then becomes evident when you uncover it more or less by taking away connections that may have sort of covered it up. Mm. So that's why that seems to be the leading theory as to why the symptoms come up at that point in life. Also, that point in life is a challenging part, more stressful in terms mm-hmm. of gaining independence and getting out on your own. But there's probably this basic brain maturation, right. Natural process at work too.
So what's going on, as you're saying, this sort of comes to light, you know, as late adolescence or, you know, in your 20s. So what happens from there? What's going on in the brain from there?
You mean in terms of schizophrenia?
Yeah.
What's happening is the miswiring, if you will, is then exposed, is one way of conceptualizing it. And then the person can no longer integrate sensory information in a sensible way. They're bombarded by pieces of information that don't make sense. And so that what results is the brain is always filling in gaps, mm-hmm. Filling in information that doesn't exist. So what can result is, for instance, a narrative that makes sense of the confused sensory information. Mm-hmm. So therefore, one narrative that works when somebody is feeling threat is that the reason I'm threatened is the FBI is after me.
Right.
And
they believe that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. You can't argue them out of it.
Yeah.
But really, what's, I think, operational here is that their brain has filled in the gaps and gave them a coherent story mm-hmm. for what is otherwise very, very confusing and absolutely terrifying.
So in a sense, they need that story to make sense of their lives.
That's right. Yeah. And it actually calmed themselves down somewhat.
Yeah. Before we went on the air, we were talking about the movie A Beautiful Mind, which you know, I'm not a psychiatrist, you are, but I think that's a good representation, right, of what it's like, you know, John Nash, who was a real person who really does have schizophrenia. And in the end, he, you know, his imaginary friends, they're there, but he doesn't interact with them.
Exactly.
And this is based on his true life. And so can somebody do that with schizophrenia? I mean, you are able to distinguish at some point, you know, what's real and what's not?
To some degree, to a better degree than he was in the beginning of the film, say.
Right.
And I use that that scene with patients to try to encourage them that they're not going to be rid of their, quote, symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
They can still have some awareness of it, but your attention is not dominated by the, in his case, the imaginary people that some of which had tormented him.
Right.
He no longer was controlled by them. They were present. He didn't have to pay him attention. He could go on and get his Nobel Prize and not crack up, so
right.
to speak. They're still present.
Yeah. We're talking about how the brain works with Dr. Mark Whaley. Our toll-free number is 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. So our capacity for learning is the greatest as children, especially young children. We all know they're like little sponges. But doesn't mean it's all doom and gloom as we age.
Thankfully.
Researchers have found that as the brain gets into a middle age, it gets better at recognizing the central ideas or the big picture. So if we keep our brains in good shape, we continue to build pathways that can help us see this big picture better than a young person can.
Exactly. And that's why if you're an employer, it makes sense to hire somebody who's experienced, because they'll see the big picture and be able to integrate a lot of different information. Whereas when you're younger, you can learn the different information, encode it, or learn the facts, so to speak, and be very good at that. But putting together and really integrating things, that comes with experience,
yeah.
wisdom.
And, of course, in recent years, we've discovered a lot more about the teen brain, and it's still developing in the area of the frontal lobes, which control judgment. And this makes so much sense, where you have, you know, teenagers who are, you know, smart, and, you know, they know right from wrong, and they do these stupid things, and you think, what is going on? It's because their brain has not fully developed in that area. And so is the research showing that it's really more about age, what, 25 or so before our brains are fully developed?
Apparently, yes. Around that age, mid-20s, that the frontal lobe is pretty much fully formed. And like you were saying, the frontal lobe in large part has to do with judgment and applying brakes to other parts of the brain that push forward.
Mm.
So a teenager is like, you know, an engine without brakes in some
Impulsive.
Ways. Yes.
There was a couple other interesting statistics I found on the brain. And this is one I did not know. And you knew it, but I didn't. It's not your brain that's hurting when you get a headache. The brain doesn't have any pain receptors, so
that's
it can't
right.
feel pain.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, brain surgeons can do anything they want to, at least not be held back by the pain.
That's amazing. All right, so let's not talk about depression, because certainly there are a number of people that suffer from depression. So what's going on, or how does depression affect what's happening in our brain?
Well, you say, how does depression affect? It might be what's happening in the brain affects depression, brings on depression. We don't know what comes first, the chicken or the egg. But at any rate, there are definite brain correlates of depression. And what's happening there, there's a number of competing theories, but basically, from the imaging studies we know, is that the emotional part of the brain might be overactive and the thinking part of the brain might be underactive.
Mm.
That's one simple way of looking at it and way of what's seen in the imaging. So that fear, apprehension, threat, is dominating the person's consciousness, whereas logical thinking is not.
Mm. And we don't know why.
We Basically, the answer is we don't know why.
Yeah, wow.
But we know that there are some things that bear on it, like the level of neurotransmitters mm-hmm. and how active certain circuits are, that definitely have a bearing on it. But whether that's the ultimate reason, and also genetics, mm-hmm. That's where the boss is in the genes.
Right. Yeah, that's for sure. All right, Betty's giving us a call from Yarmouthport. Good morning, Betty.
Good morning.
You have a question for us or a comment?
Yeah, sure.
Go ahead.
Okay. I'm calling about my husband. He's going to be 88. He's going to be 89 in September. And he has quite recently been able to be diagnosed with hardening of the arteries, is a common name. I don't recall the big name. And he just didn't seem to be a candidate for that. I mean, he's in such good physical health. He doesn't seem to follow the profile that I've been able to read about a little bit, you know, the amount that a layperson can do,
mm-hmm.
Such as, you know, his blood pressure's fine, his cholesterol's fine, his weight is fine and mm-hmm. all. But he is, his memory is just not existent any longer.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's not able to know how to walk, and so he's in a wheelchair, and has recently gone to a residence because he, in his normal height, he's 6'3", and he of course is very bent over,
mm-hmm.
and he's about 200 pounds, which
right.
is a normal weight for him.
Mm-hmm. So what's the question?
And I don't know what the prognosis is in this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just confused by
right.
the term hardening of the arteries and how we can expect this to
and how that affects memory. Okay,
his life.
Let's ask Dr. Welly. And of course, Dr. Welly can't diagnose your husband without seeing him or anything. And hardening of the arteries is more. But does that is that impact memory in cases?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Yes. Hardening of the arteries probably is just an old term that refers to effects mm-hmm. of aging, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And it's there it reflects aging in the brain, whether it's actually blood vessels that are narrowed. There's always part, you know, that's always an aspect because 89 years the pipes get mm-hmm. corroded
right.
Clogged up. Whether that's the initiating problem, or it's just that the neurons are old, or there's aspects of the buildup of plaque and tangles, and maybe aspects of Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah.
The prognosis is what you see. I mean, nobody gets out of this life alive, and it's a matter of the biggest challenge is adjusting to what is, and that's what this man is struggling with.
I guess one of the things that's probably frustrating, I'm assuming Betty's been looking at things online, and it can get so overwhelming because there's sometimes conflicting information, it's overwhelming, some stuff's hard to understand. So Betty, I would suggest maybe chatting with your doctor a little bit more to understand your husband's specific condition, and thank you for the call. That's a tough thing as you get older too, and you know, people seem perfectly healthy and everybody worries as they age about Alzheimer's. But there are many other different kinds of dementia. Alzheimer's isn't the only dementia that happens. And there's a certain amount, you know, I was telling you earlier, I had read this article, it's a couple of years ago now, about the aging, you know, middle-aged brain and how we could have injuries as children, you know, that seem minor at the time. You fall off your bike and hit your head and you might have had some mild concussion or something. But as you age, come back to that compensating. When we're young, we compensate for these things. And as we get a little bit older, some of those brain injuries that we didn't even realize were injuries show themselves.
That's right. Well, we don't have the same equipment that
right.
when we were older that, as we did when we were younger. Not enough reserve, if you will, to compensate. Sure.
Yeah. And I guess one of the things too that you know when we talk about brain injury, you know, whatever it may be, some sort of an accident, falling, head injury, or you know, car accident, disease. When you have any kind of brain injury, the impact that you're going to have in the brain depends on where it is, how much of the brain is impacted, right? So this could be,
right.
I mean, there's a whole range of things that could be happening because of that.
Absolutely, yeah. There's no one-to-one correlation of being hit by a baseball bat and, at this point in time results in A, B, and C.
Right, because we have all those chemicals and electricity, and so you cut something off over here and, you know, it's
exactly.
It impacts somewhere else. Another interesting thing I read was that your brain knows when you tickle yourself. You cannot tickle yourself.
Oh, yes,
all right, what's going on there?
Yeah, that's fascinating. If you think, first off, to understand the brain, you want to have a good grasp of evolution because the brain is a product of millions and millions of years of evolution where things were built upon one another and tried out. If you think about it, it wouldn't. And the other thing about the brain is that its main function is to provide for the organism's survival and reproduction. That's the basic bottom line. It's always in that interest. Well, if you're walking on a savanna, say, and you get all sorts of information about how it feels with your thighs, say, touching one another as you walk, you're going to be distracted. Mm-hmm. And you're not going to be very much aware when the lion or whatever animal comes after you, and you're not going to survive. So it makes sense then for the brain to, even though you feel those sensations of, say, your thighs touching or your toes touching the ground, you don't want to pay attention to them because mm-hmm. there's too many other things that are important. So as you're walking, the brain generates a prediction of what it feels like. And another part of the brain, the cerebellum, suppresses the sensation. Mm. So when you take that to tickling, you're going to, when you start to, when you get the idea that you're going to tickle yourself, you already form the anticipatory sensation about it, which is then suppressed and you can't tickle yourself.
Yeah.
However, when somebody else tickles you, that's different.
Okay,
because
if only that would work when somebody else does
right.
it to you.
Right.
So now, another interesting fact about the brain, stronger, more intense emotional connections are linked to memories prompted by scent.
By smell, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And that's because scent is what's called a primitive emotion, a primitive sensation, rather, sensory apparatus that over evolution was one of the first
mm-hmm.
That was developed first. Sight, sound, came later evolutionary-wise.
Right.
So it's very, very basically primitive, and that therefore has more connections to our body, they say, than the information from what we see.
Right, and if when you think about it, if you think of, you know, a scent, you know, something from your childhood, boy, it brings you right back there to that moment in an instant.
Right,
it's really amazing the power of that. So new connections are created each and every time you remember something or have a new thought. So even though, you know, we have this pruning as we age of what we're not using and that whole, you know, use it or lose it, we can still, even as we age, we're still making some new connections.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
We should still keep at it, too. Keeping an open mind, basically, is, I think, the best advice
mm-hmm.
And stretching your experiences. One of the recommendations from that article you referred to in the New York Times was it doesn't make sense to do to do learning tests that involve learning new facts,
mm-hmm.
but instead it makes sense to do learning tests that involve new ideas, different ways of viewing things, because that has to do with integrative structures,
right.
Whereas facts are, I guess you could say, is just more limited mm-hmm. Neural structures, neural circuits.
Yeah, with the use it or lose it, you know, there's all kinds of things I say you should do, crossword puzzles and, you know, challenge your you know, because again, as we've been pointing out, if you don't use it, they sort of die off and, mm-hmm. you know, or we have that pruning going on in our brains. So what kinds of things, like when you have, especially when I think of older patients, people who are aging, who, you know, many older people suffer from depression. You know, you're seeing all your loved ones around you die. You're the last one surviving and people are, you know, living longer. So you've got that going on in your life and, you know, maybe you've got some memory issues. So what are the kinds of things that you advise patients to do to kind of keep their brains healthy?
Healthy. Physical exercise.
Oh, yeah.
If I could, if I had a pill or something that would get people, people know they should exercise, but it's just doing it. Physical exercise, number one, I think. Certainly diet. Obviously, no smoking, mm-hmm. Moderate alcohol use, or no alcohol use, mm-hmm. Those kind of things, certainly. And then, of course, what we're talking about is stretching mm-hmm. your experience.
You know, I remember we talking about the aging brain, and I don't remember who the guest was we had on the show when we were talking about this, but whoever the doctor was, he had said that exercising, beginning that in your midlife years, has a really great impact on what will happen to you as in your older years.
I can believe that.
Yeah, so really you should start it like now if you're in your middle age.
Now.
But it's never too late.
Absolutely. Even if you're in your older years, it still makes sense to do it.
One thing we didn't mention was panic attacks, anxiety. Mm-hmm. What's going on in our brains? Because there's certainly a lot of people who suffer from anxiety and panic attacks.
Well, I think the best way of looking at that is also to look at evolution. In order to ensure survival, the organism has to react very quickly to threat and to do what's necessary, fight or run from it to survive and reproduce. So we have very primitive mechanisms for detecting threat and getting our attention for it before that go beyond what we can logically analyze. Obviously,
you can logically say, I shouldn't be afraid to drive over this bridge.
Absolutely.
But you're doing it and you're afraid.
Your body is reacting as if, you know, you're riding a lion.
Yeah.
Or there's a lion coming right at you. That's the way your body is reacting. Because what has been elicited is that threat detection system. And once it gets going, in some vulnerable people, there's not much in the way of breaks and modulation of it. So what is happening in the brain is that the threat detection system, that the amygdala is one of the central areas of the brain here, gets overactive. And again, the logic part of the brain gets underactive.
Yeah. I just want to finally, in the last, less than a minute that we have, when we're talking about memory, I know a lot of people, as they get to middle age, they get really worried. Oh my gosh, I can't remember this name. I can't remember, you have some memory issues and they think, oh, I have Alzheimer's. And a lot of times it's just we're busy and we're doing something and you're not really paying attention. And if you're not paying attention, it's not a memory.
Exactly.
You can't remember.
You don't register it.
Yeah,
it doesn't get in.
Yeah, it doesn't get in there. So I guess, unless it's if people have concerns about that, maybe they should talk to their doctor. But some memory loss it's normal.
Absolutely normal. Maybe even encouraged.
Sometimes you don't want to remember. That's right. A good point. Dr. Mark Whaley is a psychiatrist. Thanks so much for being with us this morning. Appreciate
Thank you
that.
Very much.
I'm Indy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is hosted and produced by Mindy Todd. The executive producer is Steve Young. Production assistance from Naomi Ehrenberg and Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH Radio.